This episode is sponsored by Anchor by Spotify. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast, and Ashley and I can definitely personally vouch for this. First of all, it saves you a bunch of time, so we don't really talk about this, but Ashley and I both have full-time jobs, and we don't really live close by each other, so we just get together once a week, every week, and talk about our podcast, and Anchor.fm helps us a lot to get everything out there and ready to go for you all to listen to with not a lot of time needed. So first of all, Anchor will distribute your podcast for you, so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and many more. There are also creation tools right in Anchor that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or from your computer.
Also, Anchor is free, and even though you don't have to pay any money, it actually allows you to make money from your own podcast even without a minimum number of listeners. It's everything you could possibly need to make a podcast for free in one place.
So if you can't already tell, we both love Anchor. And if you're interested in starting a podcast of your own, download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Hi, listeners, and welcome to Above the Wing, a podcast to bring together all aspects of the aviation community, including engineers, journalists, mechanics, pilots, and even casual hobbyists. I'm your co-host, Kim.
And I'm your co-host, Ashley. We'll talk about all things aviation, from current events to new products and airplanes to industry trends and everything in between. Looking at our first in the news article this week, Oklahoma-based Aircraft Towing Systems Worldwide is developing a permanently installed infrastructure system that will allow aircraft to shut off their engines at the taxiway for automated towing to the gate. The system involves an electrically powered pull cart that runs on an underground monorail attached to an above-ground tow dolly. According to the company's CEO, Vincent Howie, the system would drive an aircraft's nose gear into the dolly, which would then raise via hydraulic pumps and automatically chock the nose wheels in place. The pull cart, powered by electrical circuits embedded in the walls of the underground channel, would then provide the motive force to move the airplane.
Moving on to our second headline, which is in suit with our space-themed episode this week. On July 11th, President Joe Biden released a debut photo from NASA's James Webb Space Telescope. The image shows a 4.6 billion-year-old galaxy cluster named SMACS, or SMAX-0723. The combined mass of SMAX-0723 acts as a quote-unquote gravitational lens, which distorts space to greatly magnify the light coming from the distant galaxies behind it. And this made for a super pretty photo if you haven't seen it already. And Biden had a very interesting quote just prior to revealing the photos. He said, "It's a new window into the history of our universe. And today we're going to get a glimpse of the first light to shine through that window. Light from other worlds, orbiting stars far beyond our own. It's astounding to me."
Looking at our next headline, the Airbus CEO said he sees the development of a new, very large widebody to replace the A380 as very unlikely due to the high price of fuel and airline requirements for utmost efficiency. He said, quote, "I do not challenge the argument for the need for a new plane with very big capacity, but we see that post-COVID, the need for very fuel-efficient aircraft is much more important than before the pandemic. In that respect, the best response we can give for the moment is a twin-engine aircraft such as the A350-1000, because that is the most efficient answer we can give."
And finally, our last headline for this week, there are 20 days until the Farnborough Airshow returns after the COVID-19 pause. The airshow will take place from Monday, July 18th to Friday, July 22nd, and it's its first show since 2018. On Monday through Thursday, it's open only to trade visitors, but on Friday, it's open to the public. The airshow allows 1,184 exhibitors to show off their products. Some airlines may place orders at the show, but others may wait. Just for context, at its 2018 show, or its last show, $192 billion worth of deals were completed. Some highlights to be featured at the show include Cranfield University's Saab 340 Flying Lab, as well as Embraer's E190 E2 Tech Shark. Now moving into the bulk of our episode, and as I mentioned just a couple minutes ago, that today's episode, if you couldn't already tell by our title, is going to be space-themed. So we'll be talking about the first moon landing. Since we are in July, we wanted to honor the anniversary of the first moon landing. So just for some quick facts and background about the mission, The mission itself was Apollo 11, and it took place on July 16th through July 24th, 1969. The mission's commander was Neil Armstrong, the lunar module pilot was Buzz Aldrin, and the command module pilot was Michael Collins. And these names, I feel like, are definitely household names at this point if you're at all interested in aerospace and aviation. Armstrong and Aldrin spent 2.25 hours exploring the lunar site and brought back 47.5 pounds of lunar material to examine back to Earth. On July 16th, Apollo 11 was launched by a Saturn V rocket from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. There were three stages to the spacecraft. The first was the command module. This contained the cabin for three astronauts, and this was the only part that returned to Earth. The second part was a service module, and this supported the command module in propulsion, electrical power, oxygen, and water. And finally, the last module was the lunar module, and this module consisted of two stages within itself, one for descent to land on the moon, and a second to place astronauts back into lunar orbit. So those are just some quick facts just to give you some context on exactly what was launching from Earth, what was landing on the moon, and what came back. So to kind of tickle my technical fancy, I suppose you could call it, I decided to look into a comparison between the Saturn V and the current day SpaceX Starship. The SpaceX Starship is scheduled to land NASA's Artemis 3 mission on the moon in 2025 or 2026, which is the first crewed lunar touchdown mission since the Apollo 17 in 1972, which was the successor to the first moon landing mission, Apollo 11. So I was curious to see what the differences were, how far the technology has come since the 1970s, and what really like stands out in today's spaceship or ship that will send men to the moon once again. So in terms of fuel, the Saturn V used two different types of fuel. In the first stage of the launch, which propelled the entire spacecraft out of the Earth's atmosphere, the Creolox was used, which was a combination of liquid hydrogen and kerosene. In the second and third stages of the launch, which was in space, the spacecraft used Hydrolox, which was a combination of liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. For the SpaceX Starship, there's only one type of fuel use, which is Methalox, and that is a combination of liquid methane and liquid oxygen. So the SpaceX Starship is powered by the Raptor engine, and there's only two stages of the Starship, and they're both powered by the same engine. So they really saw no need to carry different fuels on board. And I think that is an interesting distinction between the two. As I continue reading through the other categories that I decided to compare and contrast, I feel like there's the SpaceX Starship is definitely more simplistic.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking as you were comparing the two even already, is that you can tell they were not cutting down, but focusing on exactly what you said, simplifying a lot of different aspects.
Right. And I don't really know if simplifying is the right word, because the systems are still super complex. Maybe it's just maybe it's cutting down on unnecessary complexity, I guess.
Right.
Or like optimizing the design so that you didn't need all these extra stages.
Right. Almost like a work smarter, not harder.
yeah, exactly. And that also ties into the reusability part. So SpaceX is really chasing this idea of reusable spacecraft. That's one of the founding principles, I feel like, that they're based on, and one of their main objectives as a company. And like you said, work smarter, not harder. And this ties into that. And this also just reduces waste. So that aligns with the sustainability trend that we're seeing in the aerospace industry. But the Saturn V, which was used for the Apollo mission, is not reusable. I mean, you could recover the parts and like see the damages and the wear and stuff like that, but you couldn't really put it back into service. For the SpaceX Starship, both of the two stages can be reused both of the two stages can be recovered, and preliminary studies say that they can be reused up to 1,000 times, which is huge. That's a lot.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Moving on to thrust. The Saturn V had 7.6 million pounds of thrust, pounds force, and the SpaceX Starship had 16 million pounds, assuming there will be 37 Raptor engines. So again, it's still a preliminary projection, considering the fact that the Artemis III mission is not for at least 3 to 4 years from now. So that's also a huge, huge increase in thrust.
I know, it over doubled.
I know.
It's crazy. Like,
and I feel like that's a huge testament to the propulsion technology that we see today.
Yeah.
Like I said, the Saturn V had to use two different types of fuel to really even get it out into towards its destination. The SpaceX Starship has one type of fuel, and it's one type of fuel powers one type of engine, which can exert more than double the amount of thrust that the Saturn V did. Pretty crazy, pretty crazy. And now moving on to the height. I kind of liked this because I feel like it gave you like real life context of how like massive these spacecraft are. The height of the Saturn V was 363 feet, which was already pretty tall. The SpaceX Starship is still taller than the Saturn V. It's 394 feet, which is the tallest rocket in the world right now. For context, the Statue of Liberty is 305 feet. So not only are both spacecraft taller than the Statue of Liberty, but the SpaceX Starship is even taller than the Saturn V.
Right. It's so crazy to think, like you could look at the two and be like, oh, it's only 30 feet longer. Like, I guess, like, that's not really that much. But then when you put it in terms of, like, the Statue of Liberty, it's like, oh, like, these things are massive.
Yeah. Like, I wonder what it's like to stand on the ground near these
things. Right, next to it. Yeah, like, look up at it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, again, it's 30 feet taller, but it still has more than double the amount of thrust.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like, this thing is crazy, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
And now onto manufacturing. I feel like this is, like, this screams and really drives the nail in the coffin that SpaceX's design is much more optimized. And this probably has positive financial implications for NASA, who is contracting SpaceX to build this booster, really. So the Saturn V had different companies manufacture the different stages. Boeing manufactured the first stage, North American Aviation manufactured the second stage, and Douglas Aircraft Company manufactured the third stage, and another company manufactured the engines, Rocketdyne. But for the SpaceX Starships, it's SpaceX for all the stages and all the engines. Like, yeah, it must be super logistically enticing for NASA. And like I said, it probably has some good financial implications too.
Yeah, I know, that's true. I wonder if it, like, having everything done in-house, essentially, I wonder if that makes it easier or complicated, you know? Like, I guess one nice thing about multiple companies is, like, that diversity in thought. And, like, I don't know, like, I wonder if that helps at all or could hinder. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though.
I agree with you. I mean, in my experience in the aerospace industry, I've worked with companies. Like, we've had projects with other companies that were external companies, really. And I don't know, I kind of like working with them.
Yeah, right.
But at the same time, like, there's definitely other logistical issues too. Like,
yeah,
you guys might not use, like, I don't know, like, someone might use Microsoft Excel 2012, right, and someone might use 2016. Like, there's small, yeah, like, logistic issues that you don't really think about that will definitely be eliminated if everything is done in-house.
Right. To create more hoops to jump through.
Yeah. But with that being said, it doesn't seem like SpaceX has a problem developing, like, the tallest rocket in the world.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. They found a way to do it, so.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm curious to see what, I'm glad you brought that up, Ashley. I'm curious to see, like, how the project managers felt.
Right, yeah.
In Saturn V versus SpaceX.
So, thinking back on when we were watching the Challenger series, one thing that really stood out to me was looking at the different ways that it was covered in the media. So, I wanted to sort of look at that for the first moon landing, too. Something that is often referred to as, you know, one of the biggest news spectacles that our country has seen. So, looking back on the, you know, the actual day, the live event of the landing happening,
600 million people watched the event live on TV that day. It was covered by all the big networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, and 94% of people who were watching TV at that time were watching the moon landing. People who didn't own TV sets at the time, of course, this was a time when, you know, obviously not everyone had a TV, they were watching from bars, department stores, and town squares. That was sort of the thing to do.
It's interesting that you mentioned that not everyone owned TVs, because I wonder if the audience for example, the James Webb telescope, like photo releases, I wonder if that's tracked, because like you can easily like track viewers of, you know, cable networks and stuff.
Right.
But like with these, like, I don't know, these photos are shared everywhere, like every social media platform. Like, I feel like every news article or news agency is like pumping out their own stories about it. So I wonder like how far or how much farther the breadth of reach is now that we have so much access to the media. And I also wonder if that changes the public's opinion about space.
True, because it's almost like, I mean, just exactly as you said, like literally everywhere that I went online today, like it was there. Like even if you didn't, like even if you have absolutely no interest in space, like this was put in front of you somehow. So you're right. That's a really good point. And as far as like tracking it, like, yeah, like there, I can't even imagine a way, because like they had the pictures like nicely laid out, like on a website dedicated to it. But like, I can't imagine a lot of people like went to the website when you could have easily swiped through them on Instagram and then like,
yeah, about, I saw know, them on Instagram day. First. I didn't too. Even, I didn't go on the website. Okay.
No. Yeah. I did, because it was like in a link to it. Tweet or something like that, so I like clicked on it, but like I can't imagine a large number of people like are doing that in proportion to how many people just sort of saw them, you know, around.
Yeah, and you said that 600 million people watched the Apollo 11 launch.
Right.
I have to, like, when you first said that, I was like, dang, that's a lot, but I bet it's even more for people who looked at the JWST photos today. For sure. Right.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. So the moonwalk was covered by a Westinghouse camera, which was covered in a protective thermal blanket and tucked in the lunar module on the ship. The signal bounced from the module's antenna through microwave links, satellites, and landlines all around the world. And the picture was degraded in quality before it reached viewers. So viewers were, of course, sort of able to see what was going on, but the quality was nothing near maybe what we would expect today. Print headlines of the event ranged from things that were more poetic, like astronauts etch names besides history's great explorers, to something more representative of the states, like Yanks land on the moon, to the simplest of the New York Times of men walk the moon. An interesting point that I found was the coverage of the moon landing was more subdued in Moscow, as it wasn't necessarily kept a secret, but it wasn't widely shown to the public either.
That's interesting. I always like when political environments play a part in not only like media coverage, but also like how much people care about different parts of the industry, right?
Yeah. And speaking of Russia, it was sort of interweaved into some other things as well and their thoughts. The mission had a great effect on the advertising industry, and many advertisements and commercials just during this era really were space themed. One really popular, well-known one was a Panasonic ad that showed astronauts up in space watching a TV set that read, "Now you can watch the Russians coming even if you're 250,000 miles away from home."
Oh my God.
So they definitely were, you know, seizing the opportunity and poking a little fun. But, you know, the advertisers, they saw the opportunity and ran with it.
That is that's so representative of the era, I think.
Yeah. And another sort of thing that I was able to draw back to the Challenger you know, documentary was sort of a similarity here. Life magazine at the time was given exclusive access to interview and profile the three astronauts on this mission leading up to it. And that gave readers a look into their lives and really painted them as celebrities further more than just astronauts. You know, people started to idolize these guys even before they went up into space on the mission, just based on the profiles that Life magazine was able to do on them. So that definitely gave them in the mission and NASA sort of a whole different, you know, identity.
Yeah. I wonder if there is a correlation between how many people got into the space industry, regardless of like field or discipline.
True.
Like 10, 20 years after the Apollo missions. Like, I wonder, I feel like there was such a, like, at this time, there was such a, like, excitement and buzz around, like, landing on the moon and going to space. I wonder if people actually, like, acted on that buzz, you know?
Yeah, right. I know. I wonder. I was thinking about this yesterday, too, as, like, you know, the first photo came out and there was all this hype about what the rest of the photos were going to look like today. And, like, it was very exciting, yes, but, like, I have so much FOMO of, like, being able to have watched, like, the first moon landing. Like, I don't know, like, I just wish I could have, like, sat around and, like, watched that happen. Like, I don't know, that must have just been so cool to watch live.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, even today, like, for small, I guess not, no NASA launches are really small.
Right,
but
yeah.
I love watching that. Like, in, like, streaming it on YouTube, it's just exciting regardless.
Yeah.
And that's only of the rocket leaving Earth. Like, I can only imagine how exciting it was when you could watch people walking on the moon.
Yeah, I know. I can't even imagine. It's just, like, such an unknown, like everyone is, like, no one knows what's going to happen. Like,
right. Because, you know? No one has ever been there.
Right.
I wonder if the sense of community will change when the Artemis mission launches to the moon.
Right.
Because I feel like in the 70s, like you said, not everyone had TV. So a lot of people watched in, like, public places. And I'm imagining a sports bar, but instead of, like, I don't know, the NBA finals, it's like a moon landing. Like, I wonder if stuff like that is still going to happen, because that would be so cool.
I think another interesting thing that will be, like, another thing that will be interesting to watch then too is, like how politicized it gets, especially in the sense that, like, SpaceX is, you know, obviously a big hand, will have, you know, a hand in it, obviously. And, like, I don't know, I feel like there were a lot of thoughts around that, like, when they did their first launch, and so like, it'll be really interesting to see what, like, if that, well, how that shapes public opinion then, you know?
Yeah, especially because, like, instead of contracting, what, 4 American companies to build the Saturn V, now NASA's just funneling all of its funding into a single company.
Yeah, right.
So I wonder what impact that has on the industry too. Like, in terms of competition, and we know that aerospace has a pretty large hand in the American economy as well. So I wonder how that, like, if what kind of ripple effects this will cause.
Plus, I wonder what their infamous leader will do between now and then. That
will shape, Mr. Musk.
That will shape the public's perception of both him and his company.
Yes, I agree. That could also be a fun episode, maybe. We could talk about privatized spaceflight companies. Because there's a lot of a lot of interesting voices and opinions around it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, another thing that you mentioned about Life magazine basically doing profiles on these astronauts, you said it gave them a celebrity feel. I think it's interesting how back then magazines made the astronauts into celebrities, but nowadays we have celebrities paying for tickets to go on stations.
I know, that's a really good point, yeah.
So, like, now these people don't even have to, like, there's no magazine that has to profile, I don't know. I don't even know who was the recent celebrity that bought a ticket to space?
Michael Strahan.
Michael Strahan bought a ticket to space?
Yeah, didn't he go to space?
What? Wait, with who?
I don't remember. I've met him, though.
Oh, he went, oh my gosh, he was on the Blue Origin flight.
Yes.
What?
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, so he's one of them. Like, we know who Michael Strahan is. We don't need Life magazine to profile him.
Right, yeah.
Make him cool, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I feel like we're seeing an interesting shift in the industry.
Yeah, definitely.
But it's exciting. It's exciting to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
All right, so that wraps it up for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you in our next episode.
Thanks for listening.